Hello, welcome back to Making It Real, a podcast by TKS that follows our alumni all around the world. I'm your host, Isabella, from the 2018 Toronto cohort, and I am so excited to share these conversations, the insights, the tech, the problems that we talk about. So without further ado, let's go make it real. All right. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the TKS podcast. My name is Isabella, and I'm here with my friend Ayan. I'm so excited for this conversation. Ayan and I, we've known each other 5 years now, and we're just big grown adults. Like, we both have the same energy, I think. Like, we're both, like, equally as quirky and all the things, but we're, you know, we're level up in life. And so I'm really excited for this conversation, and maybe we have another one in a couple of years, and we see, you know, do we mature, do we not mature? But anyway, that's enough about me. Ayan, why don't you give a little introduction about yourself, and then we can just get into jamming out.
Yeah. Do you want me to talk about projects in the past or what I'm working on now?
What is it that makes you Ayan? And then we can start digging into some of those pieces.
Okay, cool. What I like to spend my time on is health-related projects. I think, like, increasing quality of health directly increases quality of life. So, you know, when I was in TGAS, in Activate, I worked on this idea for solving the problem of open defecation, where we were, like, literally paying people to use the toilet. It was a funny concept. We turned poop into charcoal and, you know, urine into ammonium sulfate. And then we were like, we're going to sell these products. And we got $10,000, built a prototype, got 40 people to agree to using it. It was really cool. But we realized we couldn't really do implementation because we physically weren't able to be in the pilot location, which was Nigeria. There's a lot of issues. And so since then, I pivoted to working on, you know, two main projects that I'm currently doing. The first is actually one in the space completely different. It's in senior care. So a lot of old people, they fall and they don't have any devices to call for help. So we created a sock that automatically detects when they fall and then calls for help. And also, since the sock is able to see your feet, it looks at, you know, your patterns, and it knows your walking pattern, your gait, which is like your walking speed. It can tell where you are. And so I'll know if you're going to fall in advance based on just these little metrics. And so right now, working on piloting that with a home in Calgary. So that's what I'll be up to in the summer, going to Calgary for 2 months for that pilot. And then I'll also be going to Dar es Salaam in Tanzania. Izzy will actually be nearby, but I'll be focusing on the issue of cervical cancer in Tanzania. So it's a big problem in East Africa. And so we're creating a mobile health screening unit, basically a truck. We're filling it with a bunch of screening resources. See, the way it works out is if we're able to screen 100 people per day, we're able to keep the cost of the truck up to a minimum. And so that's just what I'm working on for the summer. So I'll be in Dar es Salaam for 2 months, and then I'll be in Calgary for another 2 months, and then we'll see where things go from there.
Are you going to climb Kilimanjaro?
So I'm spending 2 weeks in Kilimanjaro with a researcher. So I am planning to climb Kilimanjaro when I'm there.
Yeah. Okay, sweet. I have a friend who's climbed it, and now she found this really amazing guide, and now three other groups she's, like, inspired to climb, so I can send you the guide, you know, propagate. But that's really, really cool. You're doing the cervical cancer truck screening with that researcher, or is that, like, an independent project, and then you're going to Kilimanjaro with the researcher? How does that work?
So that project's independent. The health researcher, she's implementing her own mobile screening unit in Kilimanjaro. We're taking that similar concept, but implementing it in Dar es Salaam. But the added piece that we have is we're creating a chatbot that essentially solves the issue of follow-up. So right now, people go for cancer screening to hospitals in Dar es Salaam, which is a more urban area. But the problem is when they get, like, told, hey, you have HPV, which is the reason you get cervical cancer, a lot of them don't come back because they don't pick up that phone call. And because there's no text message reminder system. So that's what we're implementing in DAR that's different than what the Kilimanjaro researchers do.
Cool. And so it's a mobile clinic, right? Am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah. So it's a mobile clinic in Dar es Salaam.
Okay, cool. And how are you building that mobile clinic? How much of the project is going to be actually creating the unit?
The mobile health unit, they have trucks there that are already designed for mobile health units. So it's not like something very, very, like, new. They have these trucks there that they already use for other concepts, but they haven't used it for cervical cancer screening. And right now the cost of HPV screening has gone down, and there's this new device that makes you able to screen a ton of tests at a really, really economical, like, rate. Economical isn't a word, but, like, is what I'm trying to say. Like, it's economic friendly. That's what I'm trying
to say. And is there, like, an intersection with the HPV vaccine?
The HPV vaccine would be different. This is just like screening for cervical cancer and treating it on the spot. The thing with HPV is a large percent of people have HPV. I can't give you the vaccine if you already have it. It's also very costly. And so, like, the HPV vaccine is at a point where if I would want to implement it, the way I have thought about this. I was like, I'm going to Tanzania. Would I rather be reactive or proactive, right? The problem with HPV is if I was to do that, I would do it in like a Robin Hood style model where I kind of take from the rich and give to the poor. So I would charge those who live in Dar es Salaam, Dodoma, and Mwanza, which are like the three urban cities where one third of the population lives. I would charge them like $30 when in reality it might cost 10. So then I recoup that cost, like the extra $20 for the two thirds of the population that lives in urban areas. But it's not something that we've developed yet, so we're not fully focusing on that.
Got it. But you said, so you diagnose them on the spot and then you treat them. What is that treatment process? Because there are different stages of cancer. Is there different treatments for the different stages, or can you not tell that early on?
So the main thing we're doing right now is precancerous lesions. Okay. Before, for those that have, you know, stage two and beyond cancer, we refer them to the hospital, which is what the use of the like chatbot is. That's what the chatbot's for. And also, since we're doing this in Dar, the hospitals are nearby. Whereas in Kilimanjaro, the researcher is setting up her own clinics. Whereas in this case, we can just refer them to hospital, which is basically like a 15-minute walk.
And the researcher is focused solely on HPV and cervical cancer screening. Okay, cool. So I'm nearby. I'm going to be in Burundi this summer and then Uganda afterwards. Yeah. But one of the things that I'm working on, it's a clinic that is at a primary health. And there's just different like WHO classifications of what these clinics can do. But one of the things that I was looking at, specifically yesterday, which is interesting because it kind of intersects, is the main referrals that they do are things that are beyond the scope of this clinic. And a lot of them have to do with basic emergency obstetrics care, but also cancer screening. In this entire district, there's only one hospital, the teaching hospital, that does cancer screening and cancer treatment, but they don't have it for breast cancer and one other cancer. I think it might have been colon cancer, which is really common. Okay. I think they have cervical cancer screening to some extent. But it's really interesting, like, one of the questions that we have to ask ourselves is, okay, we have this, it's a private clinic, and they want to turn it into a teaching hospital in 5 years. But one of the questions is, we definitely need to invest in obstetrics and gynecology, and that's certainly like probably the next milestone. However, the volume isn't there. For example, for it to make sense to hire an OBGYN specialist or a nurse or something to have those specialties. So I guess the question is, how can we leverage more technology, kind of like what you're saying, so that there's a lower threshold? Because it's kind of like an interesting thing to say, like, oh, we need to have more monthly pregnancy complications to justify, you know, having a specialist so that we can, like, transfer less to hospitals and that kind of thing. I think this is a really interesting point in healthcare in Africa, which is, how can we increase the leverage of our healthcare equipment, of our doctors, et cetera, so that a doctor can do more? But I'm curious if you've kind of thought about branching out on services, but give me your reflections based on that.
So here's my thought process on it. In Africa, you have a large amount of people who live in rural areas around, like if you look at Tanzania, for example, in East Africa, two-thirds live in rural areas. Like you said, only like one primary health clinic. And so the way that I see it is also there's no incentive for the patients to come into the hospital because they think about it like this. If my mom didn't go to the hospital and my dad didn't go to the hospital and they were fine, what's the point of me going into the hospital? The incentive isn't really there. And so what I've noticed is you kind of have to go to the resident or like go to the population. You have to go to like these actual patients, I guess you could say, in the rural areas. And so I think this concept of mobile screening or a mobile unit is what makes healthcare in Africa like way more accessible. The sun, it makes the cost of transportation much cheaper if you use electric vehicles and solar panels. Like it makes everything very, very cheap. And so the cost of transportation in Africa is decreasing. And so since the cost of transportation is decreasing, the easiest way to get these populations is just through a mobile unit. That's what I've noticed.
Yeah, I think also what a mobile unit solves for is specialization across a bunch of different clinics, because you don't have to have each clinic have a certain HIV threshold of, like, you know, how many people come in, then you get treated or diagnosed with HIV. If you have a mobile clinic, it can spend one day, like it can sort of like fractionalize. You invest in the equipment once and it can visit seven different clinics, each clinic on a different day. And so people know, okay, Mondays at this clinic is HIV. And then you have another mobile health unit that does cervical cancer screening or different cancer screenings. And then it's like Tuesday at this clinic. You can really spread out, and that's important. But what about the rural road infrastructure? Because that's actually one of the challenges that I've seen throughout the research is like that transportation barrier. What do you think of that?
So if you do research online, you'll probably not find any maps for a lot of these places. So it's hard to come up with a solution for rural road infrastructure when there's not a lot of data. I guess you could say you really only solve that problem by physically going there and implementing that way. But this was recently posted in the Slack, this really cool idea of drones, because the rural road infrastructure is bad. A company called Zipline essentially, they have, you know, autonomous drones that automatically deliver blood supplies, vaccines to rural areas and rural hospitals, and they get there really quickly and comes back and works in tons of weather conditions. So that's a potential solution in the future. But another problem that I do see with mobile health units is analyzation. Like, yes, I could screen a bunch of people, but to analyze it, I have to go back all the way to like a lower level lab facility. And so the main reason why is because of PCR machines. Like, PCR machines are expensive. So if someone solves the PCR machine problem, it's a win-win. But so far, not a lot of people have solved the PCR, you know, machine problem, which is why it's very costly.
So the HPV is detected by getting a specimen sampled, and then you're basically checking for the genomic profile of the virus. Is that correct? Yeah, so that's what you need. Yeah, I actually haven't heard of any, like, low-cost PCR assessments. I've actually heard, like, concerned voice a lot with, like, a lot of these initiatives to, like, one of the ways that they motivate women who are pregnant to go into antenatal care, which is ultrasounds, saying, okay, you come in, we're going to test your iron, we're going to test your folic acid, we're going to test all of these antenatal care things, and in exchange, we're going to give you an ultrasound of your baby so you can see your baby. But, like, you can carry all the supplements, and I can try to pull up a list of all the antenatal care requirements, but, like, they're trying to incentivize it through this really interesting experience. So, like, you can see what's inside of your body. Something that humans have been pregnant for ages, but now is the first time we can really take this inside world and bring it outside. But a lot of people wish to test, like, blood, especially with the high anemia levels in Africa. But it's really hard if you have a mobile group. How do you plug into all these really radical and really essential technologies? I don't know.
This is just a side kind of question. Like, one thing I've noticed is to work on these problems, you have to physically be there for a long period of time, I'd say. We had like a session in Activate where we looked at someone specifically. I think his name was Ruhi, and he was working on like an actual startup in Africa, and he realized that you just got to be there. Do you see yourself actually living in Uganda or Burundi for like a large amount of time to solve these problems? What are your thoughts on that? Because I've been to Kenya before. I went to Kenya last year, and like the quality of life there is much different. And I'm trying to think, like, could I see myself living there for multiple years? I don't really know. What are your thoughts?
I think it would depend on stage of life, but yeah, I don't feel closed off to that opportunity because I think you're so right. I think there's something, the in-person experience, and I think Zoom was really, really great for a lot of the world, but I'm kind of at the stage where I'm like, I'm ready to not twiddling my thumbs. And it's interesting, I was reading, there's like a really interesting cultured meat company that has ceased its operations, and a lot of it, we can talk about this a little bit later, but a lot of it has to do with the incentives of where the technology came from, which is high cost, low volume healthcare. And you're trying to produce a low cost, high volume product, which is food. They did a lot of really interesting work. And ultimately, because they can't have revenue, they rely on investors, and there's sort of like this investor plummet. But there's a lot of articles that critique the Silicon Valley promise of revolutionary technology and all these things. And I was like, it's so much easier to sit down and like critique the rhetoric of how these companies have raised money when really they just try to develop something totally freaking new. I'm just kind of tired of this critical culture when people like don't actually go to the place and get stuff done, or they don't start the company and really spend 5 years like developing a new technology, making strides in progress in biotech, trying to flip this incentive curve. And that's part of the thing that I'm really excited about for the summer is to actually live on ground. I'm living in the teaching hospitals about to be built, living with alongside 30 people that there might be doctors at the facility, they might be ambulance drivers, they might be public health researchers, like DEO, like all these different people. And there's a lot of different entities involved, the U.S. Embassy, this foundation called the Madeira Foundation, and then the Ubuntu Village of Life, the clinic. I'm really excited to live in a spot. There's not that much to do in the commune, but like everyone is there to build healthcare for the future. And I think that's going to be so, so, so interesting. And I'm really excited to just get my hands dirty, you know, like finally like stop theorizing so much and like really get stuff done. So yes, I think I would, but also I haven't done it before. And so I think it depends on the problem you're working on. If you're really passionate about it and if your life kind of aligns there, I think it could work. What's on your mind on that topic?
So like I have lots of family in Tanzania. Like my parents are actually born there. So life there for me is different. You know, it's kind of like I have access to a lot of things, like, you know, a driver, food, like a nice home. And so I think I could see myself living there because a lot of my family lives there, because I know what like life is like there. So like, having been to Kenya and seeing that, I think for a prolonged period of time, I could also see myself living there because I'd be having like a high quality of life just because of the conversion rate. Canadian dollars to like Tanzanian shillings, it's insane. I think I could see myself living there. For me, like the main thing is just, can I see the stuff that I'm doing is actually impacting people's lives? that's what like makes me happy. Because when I was working on the retirement home project in Calgary, and I like put the smartwatches on the 16, I put these things on the seniors to see if they would fall. And when they fell, it actually called for help and they got the help. And I would talk to family members. I'd see the impact on like people's lives. That's what like drives me forward. And so if I could go to, you know, a country like East Africa and with safety in mind, be able to see the impact, I'd for sure go.
Yeah.
Because I don't think quality is the big issue. Yeah.
No, you're so right. There's a privilege to us being from like Canada or whatever, yeah. There's a conversion rate. There's a privilege. And I think that's something that I want to be conscious of. Yeah, I want to be conscious of who I am, the context I come from. Like, I'm not a local. In Burundi, I don't speak French. Knowing my place and knowing that I have some value to add. And so I'm really excited yeah. to see what happens.
One thing I'm thinking about is, like, so when I was in the TKS program, literally, like, all my friends were in TKS, and we all lived in Toronto. And then, you know, as you grow up, you have less friends who are in TKS who are near you. Like right now, I'm at Western, and mm-hmm. there's maybe three TKS alum here. And out of like the three, one of them I talk to on a day-to-day basis. Like we literally live in the same hall, which is amazing. But
yeah,
when I moved to a country like East Africa, when I moved to countries in East Africa or work on these projects there, there's a lot less TKS alum to connect with. Or I guess you could say like a friend group. And that's something that I'm also thinking about. Like if I'm going to spend a large amount of my life in these countries, I just wonder like what my friend circle will look like. And I think that that definitely has an impact on my mental health for sure. Having friends around me who are as motivated and like, you know, as ambitious and care about helping the world is like very important. And I think like those physical interactions are interesting. And it's just something I like think about, like, you know, if I move to Africa and I like live there, yeah, I'm going to be working on all these impactful things, but I guess I'll see my friends less maybe, but I don't know. It's yeah. just like a thought that came to mind as you were talking.
Yeah. You might make different friends, kind of a thing that I've realized. I grew up my entire life in North America, in Toronto specifically, like lived in the same house. And I recently am now in Singapore. This is the opposite side of the world. And no one from my family has ever been to Asia before. Most people I know have never been to Asia. So you kind of come here and you're like, this is like totally what would be considered a fresh start. But then you realize, like it like actually blew my mind within the first week. Like my old worlds were colliding. Like I saw Tanisha was in Singapore like the first 2 weeks when one of our friends, the first 2 weeks that I was there, I was like, oh my God, Naveed was there. I had met a bunch of TKS kids who did the program in Singapore. And then you start to realize, you're like, oh my God, the world is really colliding here. And there's no such thing as a fresh start, which I think is kind of nice. If you asked me like 8 months ago when I was starting to see like, okay, where do I want to move in 2023? Like, oh, what's a place that's further from anyone that you would ever see? Like, I would say Singapore. Last week, I saw one of my long friends who, like, I've only seen her in California or Nevada, and, like, we were in Singapore together. Like, it's just, like, this weird concept. The world does collide. Like, for example, we're literally in neighboring countries. Like, we're going to be neighboring countries in East Africa this summer.
Yeah.
Sure, it might be first, like, I mean, TKS is also a really young program, relatively speaking. And so, like, in 5 years, when things are ready to move to Kenya or Tanzania or Uganda or Rwanda, or there might be already other people who are spending their summers piloting these projects, these, like, really interesting organizations. Also, it's turning into a really happening place. Like, I think Nairobi is getting a lot of attention. Interesting spot. And so, in 5 years, in 10 years, who knows? There'll be different circles. And I think that's really exciting for me. Something that I've definitely taken away from moving to Singapore.
Yeah, because you've traveled a lot more than I have. Like, are you going to go to India?
I really wanted to, and I really thought about this because I think India is this like incredible. First of all, it's just huge, and I realized that like I couldn't really do it justice in 2 weeks, which is the maximum time I had to allocate. And so I think I want to go to India for like at least a month. I don't want to rush India. There's tons and tons of stuff happening. Hyderabad is turning into this biotech scene. There's so much going on, and I don't want to like do it incompletely. And so I don't think I'm going to do India this time. But like I'm going to Taipei next week. I'm also going to do the Philippines for a little bit, just islands, and then Thailand I'm doing for 2 weeks with my friend, which I'm so, so stoked about. And maybe we'll pop into
Canada. That is so cool.
Yeah, I mean, okay, when you're in this part of the world, like, sure, the ticket costs $2,000 to get to wherever you want to go, but, like, anywhere else, relatively expensive. I mean, part of it is that same concept, the conversion rate. You definitely have to study abroad. Study abroad for as long as you can, because if you're paying the same cost of going to school and, like, London, Ontario, but you could be in England, you could be in Singapore, you could be in Sydney, like you can be in all these different places, and I think do it while you can.
So like the way I'm thinking about my next few years of university is like I came to Western and I was like, okay, this is interesting. Like I've never experienced the whole party life before. And Western, for those of you that are from Canada, know this is like the party school. And so it's interesting. And so I did. And I did this for about like a month-ish. And at the end, I was just like, oh, okay, this is like just boring. Like, it just isn't it. And so I experienced party life at university. I experienced what it's kind of like being independent and living alone, since I am like by myself here. It's very, very far away. And so since I've like now experienced these two things, I think like next year, I don't see the content within university being something that I can't learn while not being there. Mm-hmm. And the content is not what I'm paying for. I'm paying a lot for the experiences of living alone, the experience of figuring out myself, which I kind of already know through Activate, etc. And so for me, I don't think I'll come to university second year. I think like the first year was a good experience of being independent and seeing what life is like. Whereas in the second year, it's more just actually living on my own, figuring out, you know, where it is I'm going to live based on these two projects that I'm working on and seeing the success of both and going from there. But I definitely don't think like university is like a good option for me, because like you said, if I was just to stay in London, Ontario again, it wouldn't be that much fun, right?
Right. Yeah, I think you're doing good economic analysis. You're putting in money, but to live alone, you could probably live alone on whatever you're paying to live in London.
Yeah.
I'm sure the rent costs are ridiculous because it's a university town, everything's inflated, there's too many students, all these different things. The rent I pay to live in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, I could probably get a student flat of some sort in Toronto, like downtown Toronto, for that money.
Yeah.
To live in like a small suburban town or like the equivalent of London, Waterloo, all these places, versus being able to live in Bangkok. I could totally live in Bangkok for whatever I'm paying in Chapel Hill, probably twice over. And it's like, I want to be in the position where if there's a really, really interesting person to meet, I'm a flight away. Or I can afford whatever flight. Like, I think that's, like, life is built around the people you're with. And that's one of the things that I really struggle with in university, is you kind of have that whole party scene, but it's like this empty pursuit of attention or status.
Yeah.
What you were saying, like, when it became boring, and I'm curious on your reflection there, but I don't know, it feels a little bit empty sometimes. And I think having the people who push you to think the way that is really ambitious or problem-oriented, I think that's really, really useful. And university can sometimes lack that. But what makes up an interesting person and an interesting friend to you? And let's go back to what you said earlier with mental health. How does that affect your overall happiness, your mental health, beyond that hedonic treadmill that we kind of touched on? And it's a very TGS Activate first session vibes.
For me, a big thing is ambition. I like love people who are like ambitious, who like really want to do things that matter. Doing things that matter is really big, because I think Naveen Nadeem explained this, but like, there's tons of Uber for bartender type ideas, but there's not a lot of, you know, like zip lines, like autonomous drones, not for package delivery in America, but for like blood delivery. There's way less of those. And so I love meeting with people who are ambitious about things that matter. A lot of times for me, it's like this, people who have perspective, who have like a lot of life perspective, because when you come to university, you're not just meeting kids who are from your local town, you're meeting kids from across the world. Like, I know some of my closest friends are from India. Some of them live in New Delhi. Some of them are from Tanzania. Others are from Kenya. And they have like this really big life experience. And people who take the life experience and then use it for something ambitious, those are two big things for me. Obviously, people who are like humble, kind, etc. One thing I have noticed is people who do have egos or high egos, sometimes those people actually end up being the ones who create cool things, because they have such a high ego. They're like, yeah, I could do this. As you go through university, you start to fail more when you work on any sort of company or any project. And then that obviously brings your ego down. But for me, like, I think it's like a mix of three things. Like, you know, generally speaking, perspective, ambition, and then obviously just like kind people.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I like the point on ego, actually, because I think there's a difference between ego and belief, like belief in yourself, competency. And I think the simplest to have competency within yourself but not like an overinflated ego is just looking at examples. Like, for example, my parents, they studied so hard within university. Like, they studied during a country that was falling apart. I'm trying to do a lot of things at once. I'm trying to go to university. I'm marketing an internship. I'm like preparing for this project in the summer, like all these different things. And I think to myself, I don't think I'm working as hard as my parents were working when they were in university.
Yeah.
That's the simplest example, like really comparing. When I reflect with a lot of people, it's like, do you think you're working as hard as your parents' generation or your grandparents? And it's like, probably not. Like, think about the people who, they're a single mom, they work 2 8-hour shift jobs. That, I think, takes a lot of mental strength. And I recently took up like a shift job just because I was like, okay, I need a little bit of money, so like, let me do that quickly. But also, like, I've never worked as a server. Let me at least see what it's like. And it was so mind-numbing. I took 3 shifts, and it was so freaking mind-numbing. It was a really interesting experience just to like bring myself to that humbleness of like,
I need money right now. And so I'm going to do something. Got inspired by Luke, actually, who when he was in New York working this like epic job, he applied to work at McDonald's and did the training for McDonald's. Just like for the heck of it. And I think that's a really interesting thing, like knowing that you're competent and like kind of experiencing at least a portion of working hard. It kind of gave me empathy for people who are students and they like, study really hard, get the best grades, but then they have to like work, you know, a night job at a restaurant or all these places. I think realizing that you're probably working at like a fraction of where you could be is a good way to develop competency and believe in yourself, but without becoming too full of yourself. I think that's knowing that other people could do it too, if that makes sense. I don't know.
Yeah. What do you think? No, that makes sense. The thing that I'm thinking about was the second part of your question, which is the mental health piece, like how much of my friend group affects my mental health. I grew up as an only child. So the way my days would work is I wake up, I go to school, talk to friends, but I come home and I like basically I'm just sitting there alone working or like, you know, maybe on like a Zoom call here and there. And what I noticed is my mental health is affected by the day-to-day interactions that I have with people. The more ambitious people that are on me, the more types of conversations, just like the one that we're having right now. Yeah. I guess happier, you could say, I feel, or like more productive or motivated to get shit done. I feel like sometimes on the weekends, I'll literally just listen to the old TKS podcast, or I actually have like recordings. I have recordings of our old sessions, and I would like listen to these recordings. And so like, I'll just, you know, like just try to keep myself indulged in the environment, because it's not like I'm going to a TKS session every week. I'm not. And it's not like I'm in contact with the director every single week. I'm not. I'm like living my own life. And the friend group that I keep around me is something that I have to decide. Like, I didn't really notice this when I came to university. I kind of like just said hi to everybody, trying to make as many friends as possible. But I realized how much that affects the way you spend your time and your productivity. And so choosing the right people to be around for me has been a huge factor for my mental health. Really just making sure that I'm around people who are nice, uplifting, generally give like good feedback, not people who like sugarcoat and who are like, oh my God, you're working on this cool project. There's tons of people who are like, oh my God, you're working on this cool project. Damn, I could never do that. But then the people that I want to be around are like the ones who are like, you're working on this cool project. Okay, but like, what are you actually, like, are you getting work done? Are there results being produced? Or are you just like saying you're working on this cool project? And so that has been huge for my mental health. Just finding the people that are like authentic and really care about me being better as a person.
I think so too. But okay, I want to go back to mental health, because I think this is a really interesting thing. It's sort of been recently named in a mainstream way. Like, I think our parents didn't talk about mental health when we were children because their parents didn't talk to them about mental health. This idea of mental health has sort of come up as a function of development, because developed societies, developed childhoods don't involve sacrifice in the same way that they did before, and they involve options. I think options is the key part, because when you have options, you can choose your friend group, or you can choose a course of study, you can choose how you spend your time. But a lot of people don't have that. Like, a lot of people just have to work because they have to work, or you're a girl and you have to drop out of school when you get your period because you just have to. Like, that is just part of it. And so it's like the health of your brain doesn't come into question, because like, now it's not about your brain health, it's about, can you live tomorrow? Can you eat? Will you be able to have water for your family? I think that's a really interesting thing to reflect on, like within this like discourse of mental health, which I think is really important nonetheless, but it still comes with a layer of privilege. And we have to sort of balance those two things. And also, I think part of it is a lot of societies, most people are kind of, like for women, are second class citizens in a lot of countries around the world, in a lot of communities around the world. I'm sure there's places within Canada where women are still treated as second class citizens, just depending on that like different subgroup. And when you are a subordinate to someone else, you could be struggling with postpartum depression. You could be struggling with a lot of these really, really real things, but it's like you don't have that option to talk about it. And if it can't be talked about, it can't be labeled. I don't know. It's kind of an interesting And I think, I'm not sure if you have any reflections on that, but it's like a teeter-totter.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's a weird subject to talk about, because I'm more aware of it just because of the fact that I have friends who have gone through things, and so it's much easier for me to talk about these type of things or be aware of it. But it's sad to see, like, the other end of the spectrum as well, to, like, understand what life would be like if a lot of people didn't get the help that they needed. And I think, especially because I'm from an immigrant family, I guess you could say, it's this big thing of like, don't ask for help when there is an issue with you. Like, you just got to hold it and hug it. And it's like, all right, cool. Like, I'm just going to move on, even though I'm not feeling the best today. And I'm not feeling the best the next day. I'm not feeling the best the next week. You know, me and you are energetic people. But there's definitely days where we're, like, not feeling, you know, all happy, right? And what, like, the thing that I did is I just started to do in my daily update literally just a number. I was just like, how do I feel today? And like when I would see mm-hmm. that number was like starting to get like lower or like not above you know 3 out of 5 or you know not a high number for a longer period of time, that's when I started to think, okay, like I need to change something myself or ask for help. It was like as simple as that. But yeah, it definitely starts with like this whole like self internalization process and just understanding yourself, which we got lucky to do because when we were in Activate, that was like really, really big, where you just like literally take time to understand yourself, meditate, etc. That I still use till today.
Yeah, no, and I think it actually intersects with Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Once you have those like two base levels set, you do have that room for self-actualization, self-reflection. Reflection, you can put your stream of consciousness on a piece of paper and call that journaling, sure. But like where it really becomes action is exactly what you just said. You either have to change something or you have to ask for help. And the whole idea is like you're some particle moving on a line and this line is not working for you. So either you have to have the energy or something, some force that can help you move on that line, or someone has to do it for you. Or like some constant, like you have some will to change because otherwise Newton's law stands. Like an object will motion will stay in motion and an object at rest will stay in rest. Like that is inertia.
Yeah.
And there's going to be all these different things acting upon you, but it's like you have to have some force that is greater. And if you don't have optionality within your life, you can't change that. So if you're in a situation where you're like financially gridlocked, like you're kind of a burden to your debt, you can have all the aspirations to start your Gracie company or to buy a home, but like you are burdened by your debt. The bank will never let you take out a loan to buy that mortgage or whatever all these different things are. And
yeah.
So it's like even within that, like within a sort of developed economy context, you can work like a high paying, a good job, and you could still be burdened by all the sort of skeletons in the closet. And I think that's something that I've really been keeping in mind. How can I keep liberation? Because if you have a lot of these different obligations, and especially ones that you don't really choose or you don't really understand the repercussions, that can really be detrimental, I think, to your life because you just have less optionality to move when things get hard.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why making good friends early on is really important too because they can push you.
Yeah, one thing I also noticed with friends is being comfortable with being lonely, like not lonely, but being comfortable with not having a lot of friends. Because when you're in high school, you know people because they went to your feeder school, like your middle school. Because they went to your middle school, you know them because they're in your high school. You say hi to them all the time. And then when you go to university, you know, you say hi to people, etc. But when you grow up and you're not in university, I thought about this, I'm not going to be in university next year. So like, I'm not going to be surrounded by a bunch of people in the cafeteria or a bunch of people I know at the gym or a bunch of people like that. There's just like, I guess you'd say feeling of not having a lot of friends, but that's not a bad thing. Like it's not, like, I don't know why it's associated with like a bad thing. It's not like just because I don't say hi to a lot of people, because I don't talk to a lot of people on a daily basis. Maybe I talk to a couple here and there. That doesn't mean that I should be less happy. You know, I could still be like happy when talking to like less people, but I'm having like more deeper and meaningful interactions with those fewer people. Because when I get older, I probably won't be around that many people. That's just a thought that I've been having recently. Like, I'm okay with being lonely type thing.
Yeah, it's quality over quantity. And it's something you have to really internalize and accept. First of all, something that Nadeem actually told me, like, why is like kind of in this period of confusion because I didn't feel like I had a lot of friends. And this was a couple of years ago. It was also during COVID. I took this room that we called the messy room because it was kind of like where the accumulation of our junk ended up. And I took this office and it became my little sanctuary where I would study, work on my Nigeria project, maternal mortality one. And it got to the point where I was like, okay, I have a good daily routine, but I still feel pretty lonely. Like there's something missing here because like, okay, I put in the effort. Like I tried to make a lot of these different friends, but I don't know. It felt a little bit empty. Like that's just the best way I could describe it. And then Dean told me something and he's like, it's lonely at the top. And I think that's like it's been a very valuable thing to reflect on, especially since I've told that to some people and like some people had a really visceral reaction to that. Actually someone who I'm so glad is no longer in my life anymore, like after telling that. And like, it's a mantra that I really appreciate. And it's also been a little bit of a litmus test, like to, you know, let people know sometimes like that is something that I really resonated with. And they'll be like, well, you know, like you think of yourself too highly or, oh, what you think that like you're too good for people. And I'm like, no, actually, like I really try out of the kindness of my heart to be like a really helpful person, like no matter where someone comes from and all these different things. But when I feel resonation with someone who to be my close friend or to be someone that, I don't know, has really supported me through times, I found that it kind of corresponds with this more niche group of people. And I think that's because I don't think in a sort of regular way. Like, I've had different experiences that have shaped my mind, and I really struggle to enjoy the party or to enjoy, I don't know, the conventional of young adulthood. That phrase, like, it's lonely at the top, has given me a lot of comfort to, A, bask in that loneliness, because I feel very strongly about my values, and that's not something that I'm willing to change. And so if that means my pool for people who resonate with values is smaller, that's fine with me, because it probably means I'm being a little niche and selective. But it's taken a long time to have the courage to accept that and to, like, be fine and, like, actually really enjoy time alone. And, like, I've probably eaten dinner at a restaurant alone more times with myself than with other people. But what about you? How have you gone about that loneliness and, like, getting comfortable? I think part of it is you're an only child, which does help with the training ground.
Yeah, I was going to say. Exactly. Yeah, the only child thing definitely helps. Another thing that I started to realize, the people I spend the most amount of time around are usually the people that add the most amount of value to me currently, and that I also add the most amount of value to. So to add those two things, the most amount of value I add to you and you add the amount of value you add to me, if that number is the highest, I'm probably spending the most amount of time with you. I don't know how much that correlates with, like, friends. And people are like, oh, I guess your friend group changes a lot then. No, it's just like I'm working on different projects. And because I'm working on different projects, the people that will add value to me and the people that I will add value to are aligned with the same things that I'm working on. And a lot of times when you're like a solo founder, I guess you could say, and you don't necessarily have co-founders, you're not really hanging around a lot of people. Like Nadeem said, it's lonely at the top. I bet you he quoted that from Drake, because I definitely heard that in a Drake song. But yeah, being an only child helped. And then also just realizing this, like, you know, value, the time spent with people is just how much value I add to them and they add to me. Don't necessarily think of that as like a bad thing, because some people are like, oh, you know, value is just purely intellectual value. Like, no, value is also emotional. Like, I'll spend time with someone and they'll make me laugh and I'll make them laugh. And that's also, like, you know, value in my life as well. But I think it's like the combination of those two scores that help me see who I spent or like my time around, and just realizing that, you know, if there's not a lot of people who are high scoring value adding to me and I'm adding to them, then I'm probably not spending a lot of time with a lot of people, which is fine.
I think it's a good awareness to have, because I think you can easily get trapped. Oh, I'm not doing anything right now. I don't have people. And so what can I do? I can go to a bar, or I can, I don't know, do all these, like, number of things. And I think people fill their time a lot. And I think that's why we're getting to this point where people, like, lack purpose in the world. I think GPT is kind of signaling a lot of reflection, even though it's actually been a sort of algorithm and technology that's been in the working since, like, for a couple of years. But, like, now people are starting to talk about, you know, the implications in, like, OpenAI going from a nonprofit to now, like, kind of having to align with Microsoft's incentive structure. I think people are starting to realize, you know, before, like, when I was in grade 8, we read articles about robots, and it was like, okay, like, exercise the thought of humans becoming irreplaceable, and now it's getting a little bit closer. And so I think there's like this parallel that's happening with people are starting to feel like their lives are losing purpose, and then, like, a little bit of a threat. And so, like, how do I find purpose? And I think, like, the movement of social media as well, this, like, kind of attention-seeking, hedonistic, et cetera, I think these are forming into a cocktail that I think is merging to our mental health crisis. I don't know if you agree.
Yeah.
But it's something I've started to see a little bit more.
I agree, because a lot of my friends who are doctors, like, I'll talk to them, and I'll be like, you sure you want to be a doctor? They're like, yeah, I'm going to help all these people. And I was like, okay, like, tell me why, you know, ChatGPT-4 could, you know, pass the MCAT exam. Oh, but, like, it can't, you know, do surgery, or it can't talk to a patient. Okay, cool. Then there's this robotics company that's able to do surgery. So then what? And then they're like, oh, well, who's going to be the face-to-face care towards the patient? And I'm like, okay, so you're telling me you're a nurse, basically. Right? A nurse is like a caregiver. And then they're like, huh, interesting. And so because they don't see value in their career, because people want to add value to society and they want to feel like they add value to society. That's what people want to feel. Like, at the end of the day, I just want to feel like a valuable human being. Even the reason why I'm working on these projects, I want to add value to society. That's why I'm doing this. I think most people in their careers want to feel like they add value to society. That's why you get money for your job. You're like, okay, yeah, this is how much value I get for doing this thing. And when doctors start to, or kids who want to become doctors start to realize that they might not be able to add as much value in the future as possible, and the incentives are, like, now misaligned, yeah, that's when they start to, I guess you could say, get cooped up in the environment and then engage in hedonistic activities. So that's, like, the easy thing to do, you know, especially university. There's a ton of kids around. So I used to start by, like, judging and blaming, because being in TCAS, we're in an environment where we're, like, around all these, like, really like-minded individuals. And when we go outside, it's like, oh, this person isn't like-minded. This person isn't like-minded. Like, blah, 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 blah. And I started to do that. But then I realized, like, oh, it's actually not about judging people. It's about this realization that maybe they didn't get the same perspective that I did, which is why I look for perspective in a friend. Because if you can give someone that perspective or act like that to that person, you know, talk to them or show them your thoughts, that gives them that like extra level. Because there are a lot of people who engage in these hedonist activities, but majority of the reason why is just because they haven't seen the other side of the coin. Like, there wasn't a Naveed or Nadim for those individuals to be like, hey, you could help more people, you know? There wasn't anyone doing that. So that's just a thought that I've had, not to judge. Yeah,
I think there's a Ted Lasso quote, like, be curious, not judgmental. And there's like a really good scene that goes along with that. It's definitely worth a little bit of a Google, but I think it's really inspirational. But I think what you said earlier kind of reminded me about what we study a lot in TCAS, which is like, how does human philosophy work? Because like, philosophy has kind of stood the test of time, right? Because like, okay, sure, science, like physics 1,000 years ago was really different than physics today, but philosophy, human happiness, human purpose, like these are things that have kind of, I think the truths and the fruits are really there because our brains haven't evolved. We are still humans that like, okay, when we were in the wild and we saw a fig tree, we're going to want to devour the entire tree because our brain's like, oh my God, sweet things. Like that is not something you get on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah.
You put that in context and sugar fucking everywhere or like sugar cane and like all these like processed things. And you're like, oh my God, like your brain has the exact same reaction. There's not a something that mutes it when it happens too frequently. And I think that's like really important. Like, okay, what are the ways that our brains work? And this is where I had this theory that I've really appreciated and that I learned from reading this book from an indigenous woman who grew up in America, and she was kind of critiquing, like sort of like cementing into her indigenous teachings. This is what I did when I was on a beach in Jamaica, actually. I spent the entire week building up this little philosophy on the nurturing of a garden and how I think that's what every single human is like born to do in a way. You think about it in a lot of different ways. A garden is kind of like inherently nutritious, which is an important element. But a garden is really good because it's seasonal. And so like you have to like go through all these like different phases of life, but you're kind of going back to the seeds and you're going back to growing things. And there's like a generational aspect of it, whether it's your children or other people's children. You want something to move on to the next generation. You want to feel like, okay, I have a 2x2 square meter plot of land and I'm growing it into carrots and lettuce and all the things. But like, I want to know that that's feeding someone who's starting a farm. And that farm is you know, it's producing milk and that milk is being used starting another bit. Like, I want to know that my inputs turn into other outputs. And I think it's something that everyone has to do, except we've turned gardens of candy and alcohol and like all these different sort of, I don't know, vices in a way. And instead of giving it to other people, we save them for ourselves. And instead of going on to nurture other endeavors, they go on to like hinder a lot of people. And I think that's kind of a really visual that I've been going back to is, okay, what am I growing? And how is it helping other people? And how is it helping myself? And how is it going to live on? What values is it propagating? I think it's something really beautiful to reflect on because I think a lot of people, like, for example, your friends that want to become doctors, people say what they want to be. I think that's a lot of part of humans is we aspire. But I think we start to think about it more from our lives. Like, okay, I want to become a doctor. I want to be rich. I want to live in a penthouse. I want all these things. And it's about I with like, no, oh, I want to support my parents through their retirement. Or like, I want to have children and I want those children to have access to the entire world. Like, I don't want them to feel bounded at all. And I want them to grow up to be really, really helpful and charitable. And but like, we don't hear that a lot. People want to become a doctor because they want a secure life or all these different things. But it's kind of mass. It's the small things that I think really add up to a person. And I think there's a lot of mismatch between what people say and what people do, myself included. I think that that is something that I'm trying to strive every single day is to like close that gap between where I say I am and where I aspire to be and like every single decision that I make throughout the day.
Yeah.
Anyway, think about that. What are small things that you do in your life that add up to who you want to be? And what are some things that you want to change?
I remember Nadine saying the same thing, like, you know, you have a version 1.0 of yourself and a version 2.0 of yourself. And every day you're trying to get to the version 2.0 of yourself. And you kind of ask this question each day, am I getting closer to who I want to be? Because if you want to, you know, become the type of person that creates a large amount of impact, that does really, really good things for the world, there's kind of, you know, specific things you got to do. People who are creating the most of that impact on the world definitely aren't going clubbing every Friday, Saturday, Sunday night.
I think so too. What about you personally? Like, do you have any reflections and like some of the things, maybe Ramadan is one of them, like doing Ramadan for every year, how that's kind of impacted you as a person, but like, are there other examples?
Of like things that have made me realize that I'm not, like, there's a mismatch between the version 1.0 and 2.0?
No, like the things that are bringing you to the version 2.0. Let's give it an optimistic spin. What are some of the things that you think have really helped you? I think you being in Spider-Man costumes is a really good example because that is just like one facet of who you are as a person and how you are willing to challenge conventional standards and just like be someone that gives a lot. You give a lot of enjoyment to a lot of people. And I think that is like one example.
Yeah.
And I could think of so many others, but I think that's like a really unconventional thing that brings you to ION 2.0. And in fact, it's probably been part of like, now it's kind of like the base model. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I see that. Okay. Another thing I'd say is where that brings me to ION 2.0 is this discipline. Like we learned about this, but discipline is huge. On days when I don't want to take the cold shower, but I like still have to take it, or on days when I definitely don't want to fast, and like I'm like, yo, like, you should just go to sleep. Like that's the easiest way for people who fast to not feel the fast, the suffering of fasting, is I just go into my bed and I go to sleep. Choosing not to, having this discipline for sure has helped me a lot to become the version 2.0 myself. I think the third thing is like seeing the impact that I've, like the things that I've made have had. So like last year, 2022, when I went to Calgary and we implemented this pilot for like residents, it was like this smartwatch. When you fell down, smartwatch would call for help, and I gave it to these people, and like I saw the level of impact that like could actually be made on their lives. And when it was like their families would literally come up to me and be like, no one's done this before. Like my mom fell and she told me she was here for 4 hours, she didn't get bandaged, but like you now create this. That is what motivated me to get more towards the second version of myself. It's like creating a product that people use that actually makes impact, and seeing the impact that gives you the sense of fulfillment that I find it very hard to get from a lot of other things. I think in life we're reaching for this thing like joyful fulfillment, feeling fulfilled, and that was one of the things that made me really, really feel fulfilled, that make me try to become the version, better version.
No, yeah. I love that. I think it's appreciation. I think that's what's really addicting about building things for other people, is that when they appreciate, it's amazing. Like, I kind of had this thing where I was doing some copywriting and I didn't feel appreciated. So it's kind of like I was assigned some task. I completed the task and I was like, okay, that's it. Like there's no like feedback loop. Like, hey, like you did a really good job. There was a couple of times where like, oh, like you wrote really good questions here. Or you wrote all these things. But then I started working on this like internal product where I kind of like observed everything that was happening within the company. And like, I started to see, you know, oh, there's like these processes and like, wow, there's a lot of redundancy here. Or like, oh, there's a lot of miscommunication here. So I kind of like built this little prototype within, it was just like an Asana organization thing. And everyone was like, oh my God, like you could start an Asana consulting agency. Like this is really, really helpful. Like, wow, this is really cool. Like all these ideas flowing. It's like when you add value in a way that isn't assigned to you, I think that is where you get a lot of appreciation. And you start to realize like, oh my God, like people really like to use it. And like, I think this is going to have way more long-term impact because it's structural reorganization versus I wrote 500 words and like someone's going to use it and I like go do something. It's like, it's totally different mindset. And I think that appreciation really fuels you to continue doing hard things. Exactly what you're saying with the Calgary project.
And it was like the realization that I could have that level of impact, you know, because when I was in TKS, I was just working on all these projects and, you know, seeing the people that I could impact, but actually impacting the people's lives, that's when it's like, okay, like appreciation is addictive. I kind of like this addiction. Like this addiction is good for the world and it's good for me. This is like one of the only addictions that I'm like, I'm gonna keep on with this one, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. What about your reflections on, I'm sure it feels amazing when you help a single person. And I think sometimes our ambitious selves kind of get to the point where we're like, okay, sure, I helped 10 people, but how can I now help 1,000 people? It's kind of like skipping, like, okay, wait, help 10 people and then help 15 people and then get to 50 people and then get to 100 people and then get to 200 people. Like, slow down, 100,000, like, slow down. Like, sometimes it's nice, those, like, slow moments. But actually, why don't we use this opportunity to talk a little bit about sort of your reflections on, like, that first person you helped, maybe a little bit of how that impacted you, but also just tell us a little bit about that Calgary project. It's years in the making, which is super interesting. So why don't we speak a little bit and like take some time to like appreciate that project?
When we first put a smartwatch on a person, it was interesting because it was great since the family was also there and they said like, wow, this is amazing. And then when they fell and it worked, it felt even better. But like you said, going from 10 to 15 is the slow moments that I've got to like work on. And what I realized with the smartwatches, which is like why we pivoted to using like socks to detect falls, is because you got to charge a smartwatch and there's all these issues. And so even though I had impacted this person's life, I was still thinking this isn't exactly what the person would want. So although like we created something that impacted someone's life and was great, it wasn't the best possible version. And kind of like you do with yourself, where you try to create the best possible version of yourself, try to do the same thing with products, where you're trying to create the best possible version of a product so the user can get the most amount of value out of it. And so since then, that's why we pivoted to like these socks that, you know, you can wear for 6 months, fully machine washable, dryable, like literally just go on like you would wear a regular sock. And we can even take your regular socks and then like put a little module in and it'll automatically still detect the fall. But it was like that big step of realizing that like, yes, I made this thing. Yes, I made impact. I still got to be brutally honest about like the mishaps with it. Mm-hmm. And like one thing I realized is talking to people has been like the best thing ever. Like we did a ton of focus groups and a ton of feedback groups. Even like right now, literally in like a week, it's March 25th, on like April 4th-ish, I have like another focus group with another group of residents for the socks. So constantly getting feedback and making sure that like I'm talking to the user has been huge for this project to make sure that I'm adding as much impact as I would. Because I don't want to be blinded and say, oh, I'm like, you know, helping people. Yes, I'm helping people, but at the cost of smartwatch, which is really expensive, at the cost of the home taking extra time. I think when I was in TKS, there's tons of great ideas that came out of the focus process, but it's the implementation that is much, much more different. That when we were doing the consulting challenges, we learned a lot. And then when going into the real world, I like learned even more that like I didn't learn within the program that I have to use like the base level for what I learned to like step up on. Because talking to users and like pivoting, that's something that's crazy and that you need for creating impact. Like even when me and you were going to East Africa, I never implemented a product in East Africa. I don't understand the culture there. You know, I barely even like talked to a lot of people from there. So implementing your product there is going to be much, much harder. But that process of talking to people is what's going to help me. Not just blindsided by implementing tech and being like, oh yeah, this is helpful and cool. Make sure that they use it every day. That's the kind of process that I'm going through right now.
I think with that, it's like a really big question of maintenance. How do you, there's a different personality to implement something and maintain something.
Yeah.
And that's going to be really interesting question for you to chew on. Yeah, I want to add a lot of value to this Burundi project. It's a little bit different than what you're doing. Like yours is more entrepreneurial, mine's more intrapreneurial, like being part of like a broader vision. And I'm really, really curious and excited to see how that looks like. So I'm testing a couple of hypotheses. Like, is this the kind of work that I could get a lot of internal satisfaction from? Like, is this work meaningful enough to drive me? Like, I don't want to chase the largest salary or the largest clout wave. Like, I want to be doing work truly fulfilling, and I want to answer that, or at least not, I don't actually expect to answer it, because that's a really big question to answer within like a summer, but I want to get a little bit closer to my true north. And then the second thing is I don't want it to be just another, I don't know, hackathon type thing. Like, I want it to be something that truly lives on. And I think I'm going to also be wrestling with a similar question to you. Like, okay, I come here, maybe this isn't the company I stay for the next 10 years. Maybe this is not my like big project, but I still want it to something. And I don't want me to just like
live on. Yeah.
I want to have something, and I don't want it to just be like a PR stunt. And I think that's what, unfortunately, what a lot of people capture onto is PR stunt / resume fluff and all these different things. Like, I want to truly do work, and I think that's what I'm really excited to lean into. I cannot tell you, like, my WeWork membership recently was one of the highlights of my life, because like WeWork I associate with TKS, and like TKS like, it's fairly like a home thing, and like now that I can like wake up, like go to WeWork, just like live that, I'm so beyond happy with that. So
feel sick.
WeWork
was like the place we would go to after school. You know, you go to WeWork. Yeah, okay, cool. And then, like, just, like, literally you drive from Mississauga or Etobicoke to, like, downtown Toronto. And it felt, like, different.
All right, Ian. Well, this was phenomenal. Thank you so much for hopping
on. This
is
fun.
I guess what's kind of fun now is, like, I don't even know what country I'm going to see you in next. Maybe we hang out in Ontario. Maybe it's Burundi. Maybe it's Tanzania. Maybe it's Uganda. Maybe it's Kenya. Maybe it's who knows where else. And I think, like, that's what's really special. And so I don't know where I'll see you next, but I'm sure in due time.
I'll see you soon.
Yeah.
Sometimes
for sure. All right. Take care.
Bye.
Thanks for catching up with us. That was Making It Real by TKS, and I'm your host, Isabella. I hope you have a crazy audacious week, and I will see you next time.